Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire schools will soon begin an academic year like no other, given that we are still in a pandemic. At this point, most districts have made their plans public. Some have chosen 100% remote instruction, others 100% in-person, while many are opting for an in-between hybrid model, combining elements of both. Over the next few weeks, we here on The Exchange will be looking at all angles of this school conundrum. Today, our focus is on the health and science that districts are using to make these incredibly tough decisions. So let's hear from you, listeners. What research, what data should schools consider in making these choices? What aspects of your local district's plan do you feel are safe or unsafe? Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Ben Lockwin. He's an epidemiology and public health consultant, advising both government agencies and the private sector on COVID-19 protocols. Also with us, Paula McKinnon, president of the New Hampshire School Nurses Association, with 27 years in the field. And later on in our show, we'll hear from two superintendents as well. Ben and Paula, a big welcome to both of you. And Ben, I want to start with you. So here's the big fear. Right now, New Hampshire's virus numbers look reasonably low, depending on the district, but overall reasonably low. So the fear is schools open and then cases blow up because all of a sudden you have hundreds of people mixing together indoors for many hours a day. Ben, to you first, what needs to be in place so that that scenario does not happen?
Yeah, thanks, Laura. I think the main keys to me are, in this order in particular, distancing within the schools, within the classrooms, ventilation, mask use, cohort shepherding, which would refer to keeping class groups together, and then symptom monitoring, isolation, and testing where appropriate, and then also cleaning. So the cleaning of repeat contact or frequent contact surfaces. So I think looking at that list of potential avenues for prevention, we've got a lot of the different dimensions covered to be able to do this properly and safely.
Wow, Ben. So are those in order of importance?
They are, yeah, in my mind, they absolutely are. I think in particular, distancing in my mind is number one, because if you're not anywhere near somebody who has the potential to spread a pathogen to you, then you can't be infected by said pathogen. So that's why, to me, distancing matters a lot. It gets very difficult in schools, of course, because if you're mandating 6 feet, as we've seen, 6 feet really isn't sufficient, but it kind of just became this proxy for a number of reasons. And second place to me is the ventilation, because if you're able to clear out what could be contaminated air that everyone is sharing, then people do well with what is primarily a respiratory pathogen. Mask use certainly is a good thing, especially when educators are talking all day, when students are talking and interacting, having masks to limit the spread of respiratory particles. And then keeping classes together is this cohort shepherding idea. And so that makes tracing of symptoms and cases among, let's say, grade levels or within a classroom very much easier, because there's not as much intermixing complexity.
Sure, and then, you know who's been with who. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, exactly. And then symptom monitoring. So we will see cases, it's guaranteed. But at the same time, you know, I wanted to warn listeners and take this opportunity that one of the things I've been really concerned about for the past month or two is that as we get into the fall, we're really going to see a full confounding of coronavirus cases in addition to regular seasonal colds and flu, with rhinovirus, influenza, And there's going to be, I think, a lot of panic, both in the media and in the public, about, I don't feel well. Is it COVID-19? Should I get tested? Is it something else? And so there's, that will introduce quite a bit of, I think, panic and chaos into the situation. But we just need to maintain our vigilance and resolve with these. And then I had also on the list, of course, cleaning, which was making sure that going classroom to classroom, students are cleaning their hands before and after snacks and meals. If teachers are moving class to class, that they're maintaining good hygiene. But again, this is a respiratory pathogen, primarily respiratory transmission. And we've still not seen one contact transmission case of COVID-19 since the pandemic has begun.
Wow, that's really interesting. And yet, Ben, there has been so much emphasis on cleaning and wiping. And, you know, if you go into a business or a gym or something, they promise you that they are cleaning things to the nth degree. Now, it's nice to see everything so shiny these days. But do you think cleaning has been overemphasized because, you know, it's easy and we can do it and we know what that looks like?
Yeah, very much. I think, you know, something that I've said since back into March and April with some media articles that I've participated in, it's largely almost entirely symbolic theater. So whether it's wiping down conveyor belts, walls, shelves, doors, it's to make the public feel safer. And there really is very little scientific merit to it. I mean, certainly in situations where there could be other sorts of bacteria or viruses on surfaces that we would want to clean, you know, hygiene does go a long way to keeping us healthy as a civilization. But in particular with this SARS-CoV-2 virus, the surface cleaning has really gotten out of control. And I think to your point, for a lot of reasons, it's because it's easy to do and people have a hard time wrapping their head around abstractions. And an aerosolized droplet nuclei, which is invisible to the eye, is right. Really a mystery. So it's easy to spray a surface and wipe it and think you've done something, but it's only placebo.
Really interesting. Paula, what are school nurses especially calling for within this list of protocols that Ben mentions to go back to school safely?
Yes, I really appreciate Ben's comments because he set it up very, very well. And what the school nurses would like to see is that each level of that protection is implemented to its fullest. Sometimes described as a layer of cheese, Swiss cheese, and each one of those, such as the mask, the social distancing, the cohorting, they're very difficult to implement in schools. They're being implemented differently in many of the schools. And the model that's been thrown out there is that you have to have all these layers of Swiss cheese that aren't to their 100th degree of implementation. And we would like people to get away from the thought of that this is a menu of choices. It's not a menu of choices. And we would like to see every single one of those strategies taken to its fullest. And when it's taken to its fullest, then I think that the public will have more confidence in sending their children back to school.
Yeah,
Go ahead. Social distancing is extremely difficult to do in the school setting. There's a lot of talk about that desks can be 3 feet apart instead of six, but the message that's being missed is that anything less than 6 feet should have a mask on. So inconsistencies like that, and when the actual plans are left up to each individual district, you're going to see many different variations. And some of them are extremely good at implementing all of the public health guidelines. And others are struggling, because of finances is one, costs a lot of money to completely outfit all of your school staff with PPE. And to implement putting, plexiglass in, to implement more teachers because you've got more classrooms because you've spread the kids apart. So it certainly is a huge challenge for schools. So our stance is that let's keep it at the science. Let's teach our kids what the science is, and hopefully they will go home and model what they've learned in school as to how to combat a pandemic.
And Paula, I've heard the Swiss cheese analogy before and I like it. So correct me if I'm wrong. It's basically there's all these protocols that Ben laid out, you know, distancing, ventilation, masks, monitoring, testing, and so forth. Each one isn't perfect, but if you lay all those holy pieces of cheese on top of each other, you get pretty good coverage.
Right, right. And completely skipping using one of those pieces of cheese we are advocating for is not a good idea. Each one of them, despite the cost, needs to be taken to its fullest to the extent possible. So, you know, so some districts are leaving out some of those slices of cheese because of the cumbersomeness of implementing them.
Right. And as the weather gets colder, it's going to get a little harder. But, you know, I'm interested, Paula, you have been in the school nursing field for 27 years. I can't even imagine what it takes to be a school nurse in normal times. What about now, Paula? What's this like for you as a school nurse? And what are you hearing from your fellow school nurses?
Well, I'm hearing that it's going to be such a different way of life that it's going to be a huge challenge to make sure that you've got communication in place between the school district and the parents so that the expectations, which have completely changed. As a school nurse for 27 years, I absolutely understand the child that wakes up with a headache or a sore throat. It was totally appropriate to give them a Tylenol and send them to school and see what the day brings. Unfortunately, we can't do that this year. We have to treat everything as a possible. We'll be sending children home, we'll be sending children home for those small symptoms, and asking that they get a COVID test before returning to school. And that is a huge difference for parents. It's going to involve, it's not as simple as our kids are back in school, we can go to work. They're all going to have backup plans on those days when their child doesn't feel 100%. They're going to need to be keeping them home.
Well, and we will have two superintendents joining us later in the hour. So we'll ask about how they're thinking about that. I want to remind listeners that you can join us. Our phone number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And we here on the Exchange are planning multiple shows around this topic of this crazy academic year. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking with a panel of teachers with their thoughts. That's another show that's in the works. For today, though, we are looking at the science, the health information, the research that is driving some of these very tough decisions that districts are making. We are talking with Paula MacKinnon, president of the New Hampshire School Nurses Association, and Ben Lockwin, an epidemiology and public health consultant. I already have a bunch of emails coming in, and I want to read this one from Lisa. In relation to what your guest just said about colds and flu, our kids have been isolated from each other for months. They haven't been exposed to the germs of others like they would have been in normal times. Is this going to increase the exchange of these normal colds? Lisa says, will they be sicker than a normal fall because of this? And Ben, I'll throw that to you. Thank you, Lisa.
Yeah, thanks, Lisa. That's an interesting and great question. The short answer is probably. Now, before we turn this into more of a panic scenario than it needs to be, here's the thinking. So because kids tend to be co-located so often within schools, they're often sharing the same surfaces, the same air, they're playing sports together, and that proximity and amount of contact leads to them obviously sharing all sorts of surface flora from their skin and respiration. And now they've been at home, so there's been less of an antigen challenge, or at least less of a variable antigen challenge, which means they're not seeing as many different types of pathogens on a daily basis. But at the same time, kind of my caveat there was, typically our immune system as it gets built to previous infective agents is durable on a time scale of several months to upwards of a year or more. So it is likely that a lot of the immunity that they've had to various illnesses that they've been exposed to, those will all be retained. And the only difference is, as the children get back into contact with each other, they'll be sharing and reacting to different sorts of germs than they've been exposed to over the last several months. But I would also say that at the same time, it's not like kids haven't been going to playgrounds or retail outlets or grocery stores and things. So you know, relatively speaking, there still is a lot of exposure that we have out in public, even though we're mostly locked down.
I was actually wondering the opposite, Ben. Might we see fewer colds and stomach bugs and regular flus because people will be wearing masks, because there will be distancing, because people will be washing their hands 10 times a day? So I was actually wondering if we'd have a better season for the rest of that stuff than usual.
Yeah, and I think that's at least how I interpreted the question. That's different than how I understood it. Yes, I think you're absolutely right. If we go back to schools and back into work with these protocols in place where we're keeping distance, we have improved ventilation is the hope. We have this defense in layers concept, essentially, this Swiss cheese model. What we'll find is that other respiratory pathogens, like influenza, for example, which is highly transmissible through respiratory droplets, cases of flu, cases of common rhinovirus, which is also upper airway, typically as a transmission path, we should see those cases dramatically fall. And, you know, a lot of schools don't keep good records of how many kids have been out or with what sorts of symptoms. But if we were to look historically, year on year, and then compare that to this year, I would say with these protocols in place, we would have many fewer kids sick because of the protocols in place. I was considering the situation if the kids come back naively, let's say, and they're playing on the playground without masks on, would they react differently to challenge organisms because they haven't been together for so long? And that's kind of how I first answered it.
Well, and regarding masks, here's an email from Boris who says, do your guests have any opinions on students wearing masks? What about sharing materials? What's the best way to set up a classroom? To you first, I think, Paula, what are school nurses thinking, feeling about masks in schools? Because I've read a lot about this, that maybe little kids don't need them, but older kids do. What are you thinking, Paula?
The New Hampshire School Nurses Association is taking the stance that masks should be mandatory in all of the schools. The science is there that says the spread will be less if everyone is masked. It'll protect yourself and it'll protect the people around you. Over the age of 2, children can learn how to wear a mask. And the emphasis on children not being able to wear a mask, we feel it's a skill that needs to be taught. For example, the child who for the very first time gets eyeglasses, takes a wearing in period, it takes a teaching period to be able to get them to wear the glasses full time and to wear them appropriately. And we view this as something that needs to be taught. It's here to stay. It's not going away. And for the safety of all in the schools, it is a major way of cutting down on the pathogen spreading.
So school nurses, Paula, would like to see all kids, except for the littlest under 2, wearing masks. And sure, they might not do it perfectly, but let's train them.
Right, exactly.
Here's an email from Melinda who says, I am very dismayed by the lack of data being used. I've seen surveys of 4 districts, and the surveys are pretty consistent that 70 to 80% of parents want their children in some kind of in-person school. Melinda says, I wish schools would use data and then stand by it. This is interesting right here, what she says. I'm going to throw this to you, Ben. Melinda says, Maine is using a data-driven model where 0 to 5 active cases regionally means a full return with masks. 6 to 19 cases would mean a hybrid model, and 20 plus cases would mean a move to fully remote. Melinda says, why can't New Hampshire do this? It would get rid of some of the hysteria and emotions and just make it about data. What about that, Ben? Data versus what Melinda calls hysteria. You know, I might call understandable anxiety, but go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think setting thresholds is always helpful from a public health perspective. And that way, it's more about communication than anything. So the public knows what to expect in terms of what is tolerable versus what may cause us to flip a switch and go to some other different sort of model, as she mentions. I think in the context of looking at the prevalence that we have in regions in Maine, as well as in New Hampshire, it's very difficult to be able to assess accurately because the tests still have so much inaccuracy baked into them that really knowing what the prevalence is and how many cases that we have that are out because of COVID-19 versus other sorts of illnesses, even when tested because of false positive and false negative rates. I think setting arbitrary thresholds like that is particularly difficult in this case. But I would say the point is taken that public health turns not on feeling and opinion, but on looking at the overall population risk data and choosing a course of action. So I think risk for the public tends to very much be about feeling and not so much about data. And I would love for it to be totally data and fact driven, because then it takes opinion out of the equation and we can all agree to move forward. Or, you know what, we won't get everyone agreeing on the same things, but at least there are thresholds where we move forward as a group.
So the American Federation of Teachers, Ben, says it doesn't consider in-person school to be safe unless fewer than 5% of coronavirus tests in an area are positive. So, Ben, how much should the community in which a school is located and the coronavirus cases in that community be a major factor in how these decisions are made?
Well, I think in areas where, let's say, states that have higher prevalence than New Hampshire, and then regionally they can have very much higher levels than we have in what we consider high levels in New Hampshire, they should be concerned about that. New Hampshire is still considered a very low prevalence state, and even in our higher prevalence areas, we are still, relatively speaking, considered to be low prevalence compared to a lot of other areas across the country and internationally. So I think, you know, when the American Academy of Pediatrics issued their paper to say that they believe all students should be back in school in person and done safely, the authors of that never intended for it to be 100% risk-free. And now there's almost become this expectation out in public that we need to remove all risk from any kind of situation or equation. And that's never practical and it's never possible. I would say, kind of as a parting thought on that, outside of misinformation on social media that circulates about COVID-19, I think maybe going back to Paula's earlier point, leaving decisions for these tasks, these critical decisions and tasks up to individual cities, counties, transforms our uniform guidances into a patchwork of opinions. And I think opinion has no place in data-based decision-making.
Although to some extent, Ben, if cases are very low in Conway and Bartlett, for example, two schools that are going face-to-face, and they're higher in some of the cities, does that speak to a need for making decisions locally and looking at the local situation?
Yeah, certainly. If the cases are low and remain very low, that to me is just basically a slam dunk to ensure that all returning students are in person and we continue on using the protocols as have been laid out earlier in the show. And we also continue to monitor the potential for any case numbers to be increasing.
All right. Well, coming up, we will hear from the superintendent of the Conval District. That is a sprawling district in the southwestern part of the state, incorporates a lot of towns. We'll hear from that superintendent about the plans she is making, and we'll keep taking your calls and emails. So you can join us at exchange@nhpr.org, or you can call in at 1-800-892-6477.
Not only are we proud to support NHPR, but the return on our investment seems to be paying off as well.
Corey Snow is co-owner of Monadnock Oil & Vinegar in Peterborough and an underwriter of NHPR.
We chose NHPR partly because I'm a huge listener myself, and the feedback we've been getting since we started supporting NHPR has been fantastic. We're getting more people coming into the store and saying, hey, we heard you while we were listening to the radio the other day.
Learn more about growing your business with NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the science of school reopening. Here in the Granite State, most districts have by now released their plans for fall, which range from all remote instruction to a hybrid model to all in-person. We are asking about the data and the science behind these decisions, and we'd love your questions on that topic. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. 6477. Our guests for the hour are Ben Lockwin. He's an epidemiology and public health consultant, advising both government agencies and the private sector on COVID-19 protocols. Also with us, Paula McKinnon, president of the New Hampshire School Nurses Association with 27 years in the field. And with us now is Kimberly Rizzo-Saunders, superintendent of Contucoc Valley School District, usually called the Conval District, and that is a wide-ranging district in southwestern New Hampshire. And Kimberly, welcome. It's really great to have you. We know you're super busy these days.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So describe your district for us, please, Kimberly. How many towns and just what the character of this district is like?
So we have 9 towns. We represent 250 square miles of the southwest corner of the state of New Hampshire. And we would best be characterized as a rural school district.
And I'm guessing that is creating some transportation problems or issues, challenges, Kimberly. So let's start with those. Given the high importance on physical distancing, how is your district thinking about this transportation issue?
So transportation is definitely the biggest challenge for us in a good year. Certainly never mind a year where we are talking about having one student per bus. So we are really fortunate that the plan that we created involved over 100 people. So it really became the Conval community plan versus just the school plan. And we have worked with our parents and we have asked parents if it is at all possible to transport their student, if they could do that. And we are getting those last couple of surveys in from parents. And we are very fortunate that our parents are helping us make this work. And we have over 50% of our population saying that they will be individually transporting or working with other families in their pods to transport their students to school.
That's interesting. So families are podding up, so to speak, so that there isn't an traffic nightmare at the school. If every single parent is driving every single child, I can imagine you'd be sitting in traffic for an hour. But this is to say that you are doing some measure of opening schools, Kimberly. If you could just please describe what level of opening you're having and what level of remote instruction you're planning.
Sure. So in Conval, we K-8. Parents have the choice to send their child remotely or to be in school 5 days a week. 9 through 12 is really a hybrid model with 2 cohorts. Cohort blue comes for 4 days with a Friday as a flex day. And then the following week, cohort gold comes in. And that was done, the difference really had to do with the prioritization of that 5 days a week for K-8, but also 9-12, parents and students have more of an ability to remote in, and also the space and staffing needed to run 5 days a week was not possible. I did hear Paula talk about the staffing needs earlier. And in order to make sure that 9 to 12 could happen the way it is, we had to go to the hybrid model.
Wow, really interesting. So all in-class instruction for those who want it for all the kindergarten through eighth grade, and then a hybrid model for high school kids. What about masks, Kimberly? What are your requirements there?
So Paula really, she did an excellent job setting out the challenges, but also the what we considered as we were planning the requirements. All students K through 12 are required to wear masks. We have and are working on building in mask breaks so that when children are more than 6 feet, we're calling it physically distanced, that they can, from time to time, with direction from the teacher, be given a mask break. Because we do know that children have to learn how to wear this mask, like like glasses or like braces or like many of the things that our students learn to wear during their school years.
Well, here's an email from Katie, Kimberly, that I'd like to share with you. Katie says, my kid's school is going to mandate masks with a medical exception. Katie says, I understand that making an exception may be necessary for some students, but I'm afraid there will be parents who try to take advantage of it. What would you suggest as a procedure for medical exceptions? And Kimberly, I'd like to hear from you on this, and then perhaps to you too, Paula. But go ahead, Kimberly.
So any exception to the masks would have to go through either our student services, which includes our nursing staff, or our special ed services, and would have to be worked into very specific plans for individual students. So if I was making a suggestion, I would suggest that those processes that are really already in place for IDEA and 504 be followed in order to have any kind of medical exemption or medical exception to the mask wearing.
What do you think about that, Paula, as a school nurse? Parents who want exceptions for their kids, our emailer seems to be wondering when those should be made and when they should not.
Sure, there's going to be probably two categories of instances where it may not be feasible to have a child wear a mask. One is the children that have disabilities that Kimberly mentions would go through the IEP or 504 process. They may have sensory issues. They may have other cognitive issues that they just don't understand the importance of a mask and are unable to keep their hands off it or to keep it on. Those are the kids that should be serviced by teachers in full PPE. It's not fair to the teachers. It's not fair to the students sitting next to them. For a student to not be wearing a mask when we know that that mask wearing is to protect the people that are around you. So it's going to involve a lot more PPE. It's going to involve some creative classroom management in that regard. And as far as medical, quote, exemptions for the rest of the population, I would be hard-pressed to find a physician that would say that because of asthma, your child can't wear a mask. The pulmonologists are saying the exact opposite. There is no reason, contraindication, why a student with asthma should not be wearing a mask. They should be to protect themselves. There is no hard-based evidence that says that O2 sats go down when wearing a mask. It's simply the wearer's perceived notion that they can't breathe as well. So again, it's a matter of getting used to the mask versus wearing a mask would harm them. Now, in addition to that, for all of the schools that are offering distance learning and mandating masks, they're doing they're still providing education by distance learning. If a parent has an objection, doesn't want their child to be wearing a mask during the school day, doesn't like that environment, they have the distance learning option. So they're still getting an education. So it's letting the parents choose, but it's also the schools being firm in that, in fairness to all students and the safety of all students, you're all going to be masked.
Well, and to that point, Heather writes on Facebook, I just want to comment on what we are asking our kids to endure if they return to school. Heather says, I discussed the protocols with my 10-year-old. She almost cried and said she can't do that every day. So we're going remote. The masks and sitting in the same spot all day were her deal breakers. And what do you think about that, Kimberly, as a superintendent? Are you hearing that from parents that it's too much for kids?
I have had a small percentage of parents let me know that their child would not be returning or that they we're not comfortable with the mask. What we have, as far as this particular person, we actually aren't having our students sit in one spot all day. While they'll be in the same classroom, K-8, and the teachers will move to them, what we are doing is trying to use plexiglass dividers and the masks and those pieces to provide as normal a school experience as possible. Our students will still go to recess. How those things happen will be different. So in our plan, we created classrooms. Each classroom is part of a pod. Each pod obviously is part of a school. Well, students will go to recess in their pod versus more of a general recess like they did before. But in our district, we are trying to maintain as much normalcy as possible in the routines for children. The added piece are those requirements, those health and safety requirements that need to be in place to ensure the safety of our students, our staff, and really our whole community.
Well, and my understanding from looking at a lot of districts, Kimberly, is that there's going to be a lot of outdoor time built in, those mask breaks, especially outdoors if possible. So to Heather's point, is it possible that your students, especially the younger ones, will be getting up and out even more than usual?
Well, actually, that is the great question. So in our plan, we actually have tents coming to all of our buildings, and we are setting up outdoor classrooms that will run through early November. And so students will be spending large amounts of time outside. When we built our plan, it was really important for us to have it be research driven and informed. And one of the things that we looked at is what happened for education during the 1918 flu pandemic. And this concept of outdoor classrooms really took hold in our community. So we actually have about 60 tents coming to our different campuses, and we are really excited about what that's going to look like in the fall.
Wow, that's really cool. And, you know, Ben, I'd love your thoughts on that too, and the importance of being outdoors, how you see schools like Kimberly and Conval trying to incorporate more outdoor education and just more outdoor time. A lot of parents are saying this cannot be a bad thing, at least to get the kids outside.
Yeah, I think it's a great thing. And frankly, you know, we've seen increased trends over decades for kids that have spent more time indoors, whether it be because of just our advancing civilization infrastructure or media, games, television, that when kids don't go outside as much, they have a greater burden of mental diseases. Another thing that's really been kind of interesting to follow is when they spend less time outside, they also have, you know, less exposure to sunlight and UV, and their vitamin D levels drop. So there are lots of children who have chronic vitamin D deficiencies, which, as we know, is involved in a lot of immunologic processes in the body. So I think going outside is fantastic. I think it's fantastic from a developmental standpoint. And I think it helps students and faculty to really embrace a sense of education as it was manifest thousands of years ago. So being outside and talking and questioning nature, I think that's the fundamental principle underpinning education and curiosity. So the more we can be outside and understand our place in the universe, the better things get for kids, I think.
Well, and Kimberly, we know we have to let you go, and we know this is a very busy time for you, but I do want to give you one last chance to just give us any final message or thoughts to the families in your district.
I would say that we have a really great plan. I'm really proud of our community for coming together to create it. And we know we have a great plan, not only because, by the way, it checks all of the NPR article from August 6th, but we also know we have a great plan because we keep getting phone calls to ask if it's okay to copy our plan. But we know it because our community has large numbers of both staff and students returning to in-person. And ultimately, what that's telling us is that our parents and our teachers feel comfortable with what we've set out. We've really layered that Swiss cheese, as Paula called it, and we are ready, willing, and able for students to come back, and can't wait until September 8th.
Well, Kimberly, thank you very much for being with us. We'll talk again.
Thanks so much.
That's Kimberly Rizzo-Saunders, superintendent of the Conval District in southwestern New Hampshire. Coming up, we will talk to the superintendent of the Bedford District, and we'll take a lot more of your emails, your Facebook comments, or your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us.
As a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the science of school reopening. Most New Hampshire districts have released their plans for the fall. We're looking at the data behind these decisions, the science driving them. And let's get your questions and comments in on that topic. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. For the hour, we're joined by Ben Lockwin, an epidemiology and public health consultant, advising both government agencies and the private sector on COVID-19 protocols. Also with us, Paula McKinnon, president of the New Hampshire School Nurses Association. She's been in the field for 27 years. We just got off the phone with the superintendent of the Conval School District. Joining us now is Michael Fournier. He's superintendent of the Bedford School District. And Michael, a big welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So describe your district, Michael. How many students, staff, buildings, and so forth?
Sure. Thank you. So the Bedford School District, of course, is just south of Manchester. We have approximately 4,500 students pre-K through 12. We have six buildings, so three elementary schools, one intermediate, which houses 5-6. We have a middle school, which houses 7-8. And then, of course, our high school is 9 through 12.
And we talked throughout the hour about the number one protocol that schools are looking at and that experts are looking at is physical distancing, just not keeping people too close to each other. What tools are you using, Michael, to achieve that?
Sure. So we did extensive research on the issue regarding social distancing. And for us, that was really the lever that was an important part of why we decided on a hybrid model versus fully in person. And that was simply in order to maintain 6-foot distancing, our schools are not large enough to accommodate our population and maintain that 6 feet. And so what we're doing essentially is we have a hybrid model whereby in K through 8, our schools are reduced density by 50%. And at the high school, it's a little bit more complicated, but essentially we're reducing density to be able to maintain that 6 feet of social distancing.
So sort of staggered days, cohorts, and things like that, Michael?
Yeah, so K through 8 is probably the easiest to describe, particularly on the air without visuals. and that is, we're using an A-B model. So simply put, if your last name begins with A through K, you're going to be in school a full day on Monday, Wednesday, and every other Friday. And if your last name begins with L through Z, you'll be in school Tuesday, Thursday, and every other Friday. And on the days that you're not in school, you'll be participating in distance learning.
Sure. The high school, you want to attempt your most simple explanation? We just heard from Conval that, you know, the K through 8 and the high school are different, so.
Yes, and it's the same in Bedford. So the high school is a little bit more, it's a little bit more interesting because, as you know, high school students at the end of their high school year need to be prepared to take not only the SATs, of course, but international baccalaureate exams, advanced placement exams. And so there's not quite as much flexibility with respect to the curriculum, being able to sort of pick and choose. And so we really needed that engine driving the high school. So all that is to say that students will be in person in the morning, groups of students, cohorts, and then they will be meeting synchronously remotely with their teachers in the afternoons. And so,
synchronously means, again, even if you're going online, you're seeing that teacher live doing his or her thing. You're not sort getting an email in the morning saying, read this chapter and write something 3 days later.
That's correct. It's face-to-face instruction. And in Bedford, it's predominantly Google Meets, but for the rest of the world that doesn't use Google Meets, it's very similar to Zoom or Skype.
Sure. Well, let's take a call, all of you. And Brenda is joining us from Chester. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. One of your guests indicated, and I totally agree with him, that it would be better to base decisions as far as whether or not students go back to school based on data. The problem is that in New Hampshire, as in other states, a lot of testing has not been available. So you've had people who have come down with, you know, some symptoms and have not had the ability to get the test, or by personal preference, they've just decided not to. So it could look in an area that it's safe for students to go back, but in reality, the numbers are much higher. And I think a lot of scientists believe that that is the case, that the numbers that we're seeing are really maybe 10 times higher than what they actually are. So I guess that's just something to consider.
I am so glad that you called, and we really need to talk about the testing, Ben. We've done shows on this and are planning more shows on this as well, but she's right. We base these decisions on data, but the testing data isn't great. So give us your thoughts there, Ben, please. Ben, are you with us?
Yeah, we've had about 209,000 tests run in New Hampshire so far since the pandemic started, which is recorded on the .gov dashboard for COVID-19. And the interesting thing about that is, while that is greater than 10% of the state's population of just over a million, 1.36 million, it really represents probably only about 10% of the state, because we do duplicate testing for healthcare workers or people who are concerned, or let's say work in retail and have been tested multiple times. So the repeat testing, they are not subtracted out of the total tests run number. And yeah, I think to the point of the testing accuracy, there are a couple different antibody test units that have been coming to market that are much better than the ones we had before. And, you know, my concern has been since March that the errors that we're getting in these tests, whether it's the PCR tests or the antibody tests, false positive rates and the false negative rates are really very high to be basing a lot of our decisions on. So even saying if we could get everybody in the state 100% tested, not only then do the numbers fluctuate over the course of just days, but at the same time, getting, let's say, a false negative test result and then repeating the test and finding out that you actually are a true positive really makes it difficult to pin down what's really going on. In low prevalence areas, the way this all works is we're more likely to actually create false positives to a degree higher than the number of true positives. And the flip side is true, where in high prevalence areas, we are likely to have test results returned that have a higher false negative rate, meaning it says you're negative when you're really positive, than the number of people who are really false. So that sounds very confusing, but the reality is that testing in itself poses a problem and hasn't been the solution to our challenges, because the testing regimes that we're using are not really accurate enough yet in order to be able to use them in the precise manner that we would like to or endeavor to use them in.
Well, we've been trying to look into this on the exchange, and it's been tough, but we did get a email from the state yesterday in response, which said the state has plenty of testing capacity and supplies to meet a theoretical increase in demand. Testing labs are turning around tests within 2 days, except for Quest, which is at 3 days. So the state says people are encouraged to get tested. Asymptomatic testing remains widely available. Results are known in a matter of days. Ben, just real quick, is that your perception of how accessible and easy it is to get tested here in New Hampshire?
Yeah, there are a lot of clinics and drive-through areas that seem to be available, especially in areas where there's been greater density of positive cases. But I'm supposing that in different counties, of course, we've got a very heterogeneous approach to the testing availability. So it may be that in regions that are underserved by testing, it's been really difficult for people to ascertain where they can go to get tested, what the results are, even if they get tested. And the turnaround time historically has been several days more than a couple day turnaround. So it has been getting better, but you know, the difficult thing is because the metrics keep changing, the way we're testing keeps changing, we're essentially moving the goalposts as time moves on, and testing is really supposed to be something where the goalposts necessarily don't move.
Yeah, well, I was surprised to see Quest, which is at 3 days. That has not been my experience and my family's experience. It's been a lot longer than 3 days.
Right.
And Michael, to you as a superintendent, you know, we talked earlier in the show about the different protocols, and Ben even ranked them, you know, distancing, ventilation, masks, cohorts of students, monitoring. Testing was pretty far down on the list. What role do you see testing playing, Michael, in your back to school plan?
Well, one of the things that I think is going to be particularly important to families and certainly the school is the turnaround time for testing is going to be important with respect to students returning to school. So right now, our school nurses have just been doing an outstanding job meeting with Dr. Benjamin Chan every Friday on conference calls. And the rules, as I understand them, are pretty stringent with respect to when students need to be sent out for symptoms that are either unexpected or unknown. And so those students would need to either be quarantined or be tested. So the part that I think may be frustrating is for families who want their children to be in school, but can't be because they're waiting for test results to come back. So my hope is that I know that the governor's office has really been trying to work hard to make sure that testing capacity is increased as a result of this. But I think the inconvenience is going to lie upon individual families who will be waiting for these tests to come back when their students are asked to leave school.
Yeah, if they can get the test, it depends on the region, as Ben said. Paula, as a school nurse, I'd like your thoughts on this too, please.
I think that we're going to be seeing a lot more testing because, as it's been stated, if a child presents in school with one of even the mildest of symptoms, they're going to be sent home and a test will be asked for. So you've got a whole new pool of people that are going to end up being tested. And that's going to be new for New Hampshire, that we're getting all of these school, not all of the school children, but we're getting more school children tested. And so it will be interesting to see what the outcome, because we can all predict or surmise what the outcome may be, but we're not really going to know until we get there. So where are we going to be a month down the line when we've had more and more school children tested? How many of those are going to be asymptomatic? And it could be that symptom that they presented with was allergies, but yet they're still asymptomatic and they're still positive. So it'll be very interesting to see how all that plays out. I'd like to be able to predict it. I don't think any of us can.
No, we can't predict anything with this virus. That's one thing that we've learned. So Paula, what should happen in your opinion if a kid or a staff member tests positive for coronavirus?
Well, it's very clear what they should do. If they test positive, they need to be home for 10 days and they shouldn't return until their symptoms have improved and those 10 days have passed. So that is a statewide directive that should be followed, and I'm sure it will be by all the school districts. So that is what we'd like to see not change. There needs to be... The school districts all need to be handling these positive cases in the same way. And there is definite guidelines put out by the Department of Public Health that does guide them in that. So,
sorry, Paula, go ahead.
No, that's okay. those guidelines do exist.
Well, and Michael, what about screening? And boy, we could talk about that for 20 minutes. Are you approaching this at the school level, or are you asking parents to screen kids beforehand? And we can talk with Ben too about, you know, how valuable this is, but go ahead, Michael.
Sure. So we are actually, we're employing something called redundant screening. And so we are asking parents to screen their children at home. And then we are providing training for our teachers, our staff, on what signs and symptoms they should be looking for in the classroom and when a student would need to be sent to the nurse for sort of a second screening by the school nurse. And so we're simply not set up to be screening 4,500 students every single day. And the other piece to that logistically is, you know, social distancing and keeping kids in cohorts doesn't work well as students enter the building and need to screen them. So we're following at this juncture the recommendations of the State Department of Education and feel very comfortable with that. And we also recognize that not always do students have fevers. They can be asymptomatic as well. So that's where we are on that issue.
Right. And Ben, I want to ask you that question too, although it's going to have to be brief. What are your thoughts about these different screening protocols, given what Michael says, 40% of coronavirus, you know, carriers are asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. It's been a concern for many months, worrying about how you look at vector transmission when people are probably asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic and still therefore transmitting. My opinion is that thermometric screening, let's say when children arrive at school, is relatively to virtually useless.
Wow, that's temperature screening, Ben?
Yes, exactly. Most cases are afebrile for days while they're still infectious, and the fever threshold is arbitrary at 100.4. I think looking for symptoms is more effective, but the clinical symptoms for COVID-19 overlap and are fully confounded with influenza and other serious colds. And wow. Again, some may not have symptoms at all.
So all those temperature guns that everybody's buying, you're saying waste of time, Ben? Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to close it out there. We could have talked a lot longer. I want to thank everyone for being with us. Michael Fournier, thank you so much and good luck with the school year.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Michael Fournier, superintendent of the Bedford School District. And Paula, good luck to you too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having us.
That's Paula McKinnon, president of the New Hampshire School Nurses Association. And Ben Lockwin, it was great to talk to you too. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Ben Lockwin, epidemiology and public health consultant. We heard from a lot of teachers during the hour. Please email us because we are planning a show with teachers, how they're feeling about all this. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Teachers, we want to hear from you. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.